Good morning. Well, thanks for giving me the extra time, because I'll speak fast, but I'll use it. I'm going to be presenting on an organizational level intervention and assessment with a group in California that was trying to find out how to create more culturally and linguistically appropriate services overall. So it includes translation of materials and health literacy, but it's really more about understanding how the organization was trying to adapt itself so it actually provide services that are more culturally and linguistically appropriate. Disclosures, myself and Felicia Batts also work for a group called Alliance of Community Research and Development, which is a for-profit company. I think we have to report that. Our objectives for today are mainly to give you a sense of how the national class standards were used to guide what the organization did, Golden Valley Health Centers, and give you a sense of some of the challenges and opportunities that we had in understanding how you actually use the class standards to guide your development of services and your assessment of services. I'll also go in a little bit briefly into some of the administrative issues involved. The context of Golden Valley primarily serves Merced and Stanislaus counties. For those of you who know California, it's smack in the middle of California, called the Central Valley. And the organization was founded in 1972. It's very large. Probably what I want to cover from here, it's a very busy community health center organization. And for many of you out there who know these kinds of organizations, there's not much extra time and resources to do anything else. But it is primarily serving a Latino population, with many of its staff, over 85%, being bilingual, primarily in Spanish. Why is this organization doing this? Like many of you out there, it's really mission-driven. Many of us now are thinking maybe we can get more clients into our organizations if we're culturally appropriate. But really, most organizations, including Golden Valley, were doing this because it's written in its mission and vision. It is part of making sure you provide quality care and that patients are safe. And obviously, there's more and more emphasis on Joint Commission and emphasis on Office of Civil Rights compliance. But really, if it's not part of your mission and vision, it's unlikely to happen. In 2002, we got together and we were looking at that point, it was fairly early in the game of developing culturally and linguistically appropriate materials and services. And we asked ourselves, how can measurement help us understand and improve our services? And the working hypothesis or idea was that if we somehow influences culturally linguistically appropriate services, we would measurably see a difference in health disparities. And I think that's our overall goal with everything we're doing here. It took about 4 years just to get the assessment up and going, and this was a very grassroots, organically developed process, both the services and the assessment. We got a small grant in 2000. The organization started doing diversity training for everyone in 2001. And that was about the time we started thinking, wow, well, we're doing a lot of things, but how do we know if they're working? How do we know if we're actually making a difference? And so we started thinking of how do we assess what we do, with the first assessment done back in 2003. We used the national class standards to guide what we do. Now, raise of hands, how many people know the Office of Minority Health class standards? Don't be shy if you don't know them. Okay. So not everybody. And there's more standards being developed now. There's a National Quality Forum. There's a lot of people out there coming up with standards. Back in 2002, the national standards were the only thing we really had that was a reputable source, something trustworthy we could hang our hat on. And the standards are, there's 14. They're divided into different kinds of areas. But probably the thing most people focus on is that some of them are based on the mandates for civil rights compliance in terms of providing language assistance to people who don't speak English. And those are standards 4 through 7. Why do we use the standards? And the standards may actually help many of you develop materials as well as assessments. But one is that there was a nationwide collaborative process that actually was something that we thought was trustworthy because many people were involved in developing them. They were fairly brief, even though there's 14. They're fairly easy to understand. And probably most important is that it was something that was pre-approved. It wasn't something we were starting from scratch on. And given that resources are very thin, it was very important not to start from scratch. Our principles guiding the development of the assessment and the subsequent interventions was, one, it had to be developmental. We were looking to develop something that wasn't going to just be your right or wrong. We wanted to make sure we could organize our services in a way that we could learn from them and change over time. Very participatory. Everything that was done involved researchers as well as people from the staff and the community to try to make sure that what we did actually made sense. Complementary. All the things that were created that I'll share with you now were really things that were designed to fit with what the organization was already doing. So even though they were new, there was an emphasis on how to just build on what we already have. And multi-component, looking at ways to measure things that are not just using one way of looking at life. What we came up with was four different tools. One was a big staff survey, which I'll go into the results in a little bit, but they were all tied to the class standards in some way or form. The survey led to key informant interviews, mainly finding people in the organization that were knowledgeable and asking them, well, did the results in the survey make sense? Would these be applicable to the organization? And lastly, there's a checklist of about 100 items, just yes or no's, real quick, of does this exist or does this exist in the organization, mainly looking at policies and procedures. And from that, we synthesized the results and put recommendations together for programs. Here's an example with Standard 4. For those of you who are not familiar with Standard 4, it mainly says that if you're a healthcare organization, anyone coming through your doors needs to have language access services at all times. It's practically impossible to meet, but it's a challenge. And so from that, we developed four survey items. Can you identify the languages used by your patients? Can you describe what resources exist using medical interpreters? Fairly, fairly basic. Here's what we were trying to figure out. How do we understand this process? There were three assessments done from 2003 to 2007. So if you look at 2003, when the first assessment was done, we started writing proposals to get funding because, of course, there's no money to do anything. And so we wrote some proposals, and we got our first grant in 2004. That led to actually funding one full-time position. As many of you know, if you don't have a staff to do the work, it's probably not going to happen. So we hired our first full-time staff to do some of the training. We got another grant at that point, focusing more on HIV and limited English proficient patients. 2005 was really spent doing a lot of work. We actually got the money. Now let's do some work. We were selected in 2006 to be part of the AMA's, American Medical Association's, project for ethics and communication. And 2006 was when we first incorporated assessment of all staff in terms of language proficiency. Can the staff who actually interpret speak the language that they're interpreting in? Sounds like common sense, but it's something most people don't check. That's when we did our second assessment and got more grants, and then our third assessment in 2007. Golden Valley at this point is really full steam ahead and doing all kinds of services and materials and in terms of being culturally and linguistically appropriate. So what happened as a result of these interventions, and what kinds of changes did we see? I think you'll be surprised. What we did is in the survey, we asked people, how important is something to you and how satisfied are you with this item? And we'll share just a few of the items with you since we don't have too much time. But this item was, how would you rate your importance and satisfaction on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being high, in your ability to identify patients' need for an interpreter? Would seem kind of important, kind of hard to give people materials if you first can't figure out, you know, what language they speak and do they need help. 2003, you see, the higher the number for importance, it means that people value that. And if it's low in satisfaction, that means that they're not happy with how things are going, so something should be done. What you see here is there's pretty much consistency across all 3 years. So even though you're looking at a six-year period, it's fairly consistent. What we started to learn is that the more we did, the more staff understood that things were important, and it was easier for them to have less satisfaction because they said, you know, they became more aware of what was important to do. The ability for staff to identify different languages of the patients that they speak, again, fairly important. What you see is you start seeing towards 2007 even lower satisfaction, and staff were actually asking for materials to be translated in different languages, calling people when something wasn't happening right. So it's sort of a reverse of what you'd want to see in some ways, but the way the organization took this was, wow, people are now more aware, our staff are more aware of what needs to happen, and they're calling us on it. Ability to identify or refer patients with language access needs to different organizations, again, similar. As we got to 2007, you started seeing people saying this is important, but we need more help with this. We also asked staff to talk about their workplace, what kinds of things they need in the workplace, and the availability of forms and educational materials in different languages. Again, looking at the importance of this stays pretty consistent over time, and satisfaction, as we understood more, actually got less. People were actually calling for more. Providing training for staff, and this is an organization that already had training to begin with in 2003. By the time 2007 came around, it was clear that staff weren't only asking for more training, but they were fairly unsatisfied with ongoing training. They wanted training that was more advanced, not just introductory orientation type training on how you are culturally sensitive. Trained bilingual staff being available and readily available to interpret. Again, this is an organization that has 85% of its staff bilingual and interpreting. And what you start seeing happening here is, again, very important. But even by 2007, people are still not as satisfied with the number of staff that are available. What you started seeing is people who were actually interpreting in the organization were asking for training on how to be an interpreter, which was not happening back in 2003. Here's an example of how we sort of moved from results into recommendations. Again, here's an idea with standard four. Many staff are bilingual and represent the cultures being served, but an area for improvement is that there's not enough language interpreting available for all patients, for all languages, at all times. Now, how many of you in the organizations you work with have languages available for all patients at all times of service? Anybody? It's hard. It's possible, but thank you. Some ideas of other things that happened. So in terms of a recommendation to improve the system of assessing patient language, what language does a patient speak? And as basic as that is, it's still very difficult out there. More and more people are now moving to what language would you like to speak with your provider and moving away from what language do you prefer to speak at home, which isn't as predictive of what happens in the healthcare setting. So we actually created a standardized method for asking patients of their language preference and documenting in the chart and then just being very diligent about seeing that documentation. Some lessons, and I'm not sure if I'm preaching to the choir, but these are things that we took away from this project, from all the results that we looked at. Bilingualism, there obviously was a relationship between language proficiency and interpreting ability, and that included literacy. The assumption that many of our staff were proficient in the language they were interpreting in was probably not true. Interpreting, not all bilingual staff were able to interpret. They could speak the language, but interpreting was a whole different skill set. The training that was needed was ongoing, and for providers as well as a staff, meaning the physicians as well as the staff who interpret for them. And looking at systems change, trying to actually make sure language proficiency is something you build into your organization at all levels. Can people who are speaking for others in a different language actually speak the language, the target language, proficiently? Some takeaway lessons. It's important to have a steady voice, having someone who's going to be a leader. And everyone knows that, but actually having the right leader is even more important. And it probably needs to be someone fairly high in the organization who has some ability to move decisions. Where do you put these kinds of initiatives? They might be health education, they might be health promotion, they might be part of your quality improvement initiative. There's a lot of variability out there, and it took us a while to figure out where do we house these things. And it varies. I think our strategy was to make sure we included it in quality improvement so it could actually be broad and go across the organization. And then we also worked very closely with our human resources staff to make sure that anything we did around materials and training was incorporated with how staff are hired and supported. Where do you start? I'd say besides finding out who you bring in as a leader, making sure that who you bring in is credible. And one of the things that we learned is that having the cheerleader that everyone not necessarily doesn't look up to, but it's someone who probably could do these things in their sleep, was not very productive. It was important for us to find a leader that was actually someone who wasn't at the extreme level of doing these things, someone who was probably also struggling with these kinds of issues. And developing their leadership skills actually proved much more productive for us than actually working with the physicians who were already champions. And that's something that I don't think we expected. Resources, you know, this work was done probably with the additional assessment, probably with a small grant of around $10,000 that slowly built to larger grants in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. But most of the resources were in kind, and I think a lot of organizations, whether you're working with translating materials or interpreting, are done in ways that you use staff that are available and that are not paid any extra for this. So I think when you have money available to actually pay for professionals, it's great, but tapping into what strengths you have within your organization is usually the norm. Not reinventing the wheel. You're more than welcome to borrow what we did. I'm sure the folks have things on the internet as well. And thinking about time. What we learned is really there's practically no time to do these things, and squeezing it into existing meetings, finding, again, ways that make this stuff work within what's already happening was critical. Everything is on this link for now. I think if I can get it up on the learning, I don't know what they call that, the learning essentials. We tried, but I think I'll keep on trying later today. But either way, I made sure to put it up on this link as well, just in case people need it. Thank you.
Okay. So next we will hear from Maria Lin. I can tell you that Maria is a senior health education specialist for HealthNet, where her main responsibilities include development of health education materials for the Medi-Cal population and coordination of the overall material production process. Over the last 10 years, Maria has worked in different healthcare settings with a focus on serving low-income, low-literacy populations.